If in 1961 you had invested $1,000 in this man's company, today you would be sitting on $5 million. On Uncommon Knowledge, one of the signal figures in American business history, Charles Koch. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Born and raised in Wichita, Kansas, Charles Koch studied at MIT, worked for a few years back east, then returned to Wichita to join his father's business, then a medium-sized oil company, in 1961. In 1966, he became president of the business, which he renamed Koch Industries in honor of his father. In the half a century since, Koch Industries has grown so dramatically that it now represents the second largest privately held company in the United States. Its products run from oil to polymers to paper products to pipelines to fiber optics, and it employs almost 100,000 people, 60,000 of them here in this country. Worth $21 million in 1961, Koch Industries, of which Mr. Koch remains chairman and CEO, is now worth $100 billion. With his brother David, Charles Koch is active in politics, funding think tanks and campaigns. Mr. Koch is also the author of a number of books, including, most recently, Good Profit. Charles Koch, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on your program.
1961, the company's worth $21 million. Half a century later, it's worth $100 billion. Let me quote Good Profit. 1962, this is your second year at the company, was the year I began working to expand Rock Island's largest business, Rock Island was then the name of the company, to expand the largest business, crude oil gathering. We aggressively, that word is important, I think,
right.
We aggressively bought crude oil trucks, trucking companies and pipelines, and we built pipelines where others refused to take risks. That's a word that's important too, risks.
Right.
Now, in much of Good Profits, you sound like a very calm, serene, rational processes guy, which you'd expect from a man who has 3 degrees in engineering.
Yeah.
But here's a glimpse at somebody who thinks risk is important. And so what I'm trying to get at here is, what is your attitude toward risk? What is the company's attitude toward risk? To what extent do we owe this amazing growth of your company to intelligent, rational processes, and to what extent do we owe it to managers following your lead to take risks? Are you a good gambler?
Well, I mean,
you see what I'm getting at. You see what I'm getting at.
But no, but this MBM approach is not
market-based management.
Just one piece, and that'll work by itself. It's an integrated philosophy, and each of the five dimensions need to reinforce each other. And for example, we do not take risks with safety or the environment. I mean, safety is job one, and if there's something not working properly at a unit, we say shut it down. For example, at Georgia Pacific, when we bought it, they had their vision was to be the low-cost upgrader of Southern Pine. And so the employees really bought into that. So if a paper machine, I don't know if you've ever seen a paper, they're
big,
huge and
big,
complicated, very dangerous. The employees would tend to try to fix the machine while it's operating. And so they had a big accident rate. And we said, no, the rule, safety is first. Saving people's lives, protecting their health is first. If the machine is, you'd never work on it until it shut down. This took years to get that through. We had to fire managers, fire employees who were violating this. But that's how ingrained some of these mental models or ideas are. But we finally changed that. Every company we buy, first thing we do is improve safety and then improve the environmental practices. So those are first. So we don't take risks there. Financial risks, we evaluate, okay, what's the probability of success? What's the downside? And then how does that compare to the upside? And And part of the upside is not just the return on that investment, but will it build us new capability that'll be a new platform for growth? And when we say we took more risks than others, what we try to do is, in crude oil gathering, is understand it was mainly buying oil and transporting the oil of independent explorers and producers. So we got people to get to know each one. What do you value? What do you want? And then we'd give them maybe service. Well, we want to move our oil every day. We won't want any risk on you being late on your payments or not paying. It may be other things. Whatever it was.
Relationships are very important.
And one of our top people said, you had this saying, if you don't know what's posted on your customer's refrigerator door, you don't know your customer. Because if you don't have that close a relationship and that much trust in you, you really haven't built it. So that was the first thing, to understand what our customers value so we could satisfy. And what we found out for most of them is, okay, you have a truck there, you have a truck ready, and if they get a discovery, you're there and you move that oil immediately. They don't have to call you, wait a week for the truck to get in. Then we found, okay, that's a pain to have trucks coming in all the time. You gotta worry about the road, you gotta worry whether it's muddy or whether there's snow, all these other things. So they want a pipeline in as quickly as possible. So before there were any economics in the field, you knew it was big enough to justify a pipeline, we would go in, and we'd go in without any commitments. Just say, well, if we build a pipeline in there, will you sell us the oil to start with? 30-day division orders, they could cancel in 30 days. And we'll build these pipelines. And guess what? Since we did that, we're giving them good service. Somebody else would come in if the field got built and say, we'll build a pipeline and do it cheaper. They would give us last luck because they loved that we were committed to creating value for them and would do whatever it took to satisfy their values. That's why I'm coming back to.
Right.
If you're dedicated to creating value for your customers, you build loyalty. We have customers and suppliers that we've done business with for 40 years, and we try to help each other. If they're in a problem, rather than take advantage of them, I mean, we want to be compensated for what we're doing for them, and then the other way. And we've had some of these companies, I won't mention names, big companies say, we're the only company they have this kind of relationship with.
Right. Okay, so that story you just told, from the financial point of view, building in a pipeline without knowing whether the field would be built out was a very risky thing to do. But from the point of view of creating value for the customer, I just don't know how you fit that. I'm trying to, I have a terrible disability. I have an MBA.
Oh, so my God.
So whenever you tell a
so
story
you
like
brain
that.
Brain damage.
Exactly. I'm trying to figure out how the heck do you, this creating value, where does that fit in any matrix? Got it. Okay.
No, but we found from experience that 90% of those risks paid out, and they pay out big time.
Okay. You titled one chapter of Good Profit, Building with Stones That Fit. Quote, I often think of what we do as stonemasonry. Once a stone has been carefully selected and set, it shapes a new space in which the mason can set yet another well-chosen stone. Okay, that's a beautiful image. On the other hand, how the heck does this work? Let's just take one example. I keep saying you start in 1961, you've got crude oil gathering, and here we are in 2016, you've got 9 different business units. Let's just take an example. One of your divisions, you mentioned Georgia Pacific. Georgia Pacific, great paper company. They've got some consumer products, unusual for most of the Coke line, that they've got actual consumer products, things you go buy in a grocery store. One of their lines is Brawny paper towels.
Right.
Now, Charles, how on earth do you get from owning crude oil gathering operation to owning a company that makes Brawny paper towels? How do you get these pieces? How do you know the pieces fit together?
Well, that's good. I mean, it starts with this vision of creating value for others. Okay, So the first thing you ask yourself, okay, what are my capabilities that will create superior value for others? And what are the best opportunities for me to do that? And then as I prove that, then, okay, if I add some other capabilities to the ones I have, what new opportunities will that open up for me? And so this mental model of driving creative destruction, of constant innovation, of always trying to build new platforms for growth, realizing that, as Schumpeter said, the ground is always crumbling beneath the businessman's feet. So that was part of my studies, figuring this out. And so here's how we got there. After when my father was alive, he was worried he could die any time. And he died the way he wanted to. He was in a duck blind, shot the duck, and had a heart attack and died. That's
the way to go.
That was wonderful for him. That's the way he wanted to go. But so then we were able to negotiate his estate tax. And so we were freed from that potential large liability. And so I looked at it, okay, we got three sets of capabilities. We've got crude oil gathering, and we'd build a trading business around that to trade crude oil because at times it was hard to sell, so we needed to build that capability. Then we had the coke engineering. By this time, I'd added a lot of other products and built that capability, so we had a thriving business there. So process equipment and that kind of thing. And then the third is we had this 35% interest in this refining company, the Great Northern Oil Company. So okay, one of my first goals was to buy all of that company so we would have a processing capability in the chemical process industries, and we could use that as a platform for growth. So I was able to buy the rest of that, and that's a long story which I won't go into. But we bought that, and then we started building that, improving that refinery, and it was like 40,000 barrels a day. Now it's over 300,000 barrels a day. So we built that, and then we used that capability to buy a refinery in Corpus. We also had a chemical plant attached to it. So then we built that, and we started building the chemical business, and we started buying other chemical businesses, and then we bought DuPont's Lycra and nylon business, which in part was a forward integration of what we had at Corpus. And then we were saying, okay, we've been successful in all these different chemical process industries. What other chemical process industries that have similar requirements? That is, you're using chemical process technology, and we've gotten really good at optimizing plants. They have diverse raw materials and a diverse group of products, so we need to optimize the whole system. We've built trading capabilities for doing the best job of supplying and logistic capabilities and delivering, understanding what our customers value. Then in Invista, we had gotten consumer products with them, like...
Invista is a company you purchased in, I can't remember the year.
In 2004.
All right.
And they did. They had some consumer brands like Lycra and like Stainmaster carpet. And so we developed some capabilities. So we looked at that as a new platform for growth. So we said, okay, the pulp and paper industry is a chemical process industry. So we're going to look at that. And we did some small experiments. And then we heard that Georgia-Pacific wanted to become more of a consumer products company and get out of some of their commodity businesses, so their multiple would go up and their stock price would go up. So we approached them about buying their pulp business, and we made a deal to buy that, and we applied our management philosophy to it, made some substantial improvements. So we went back to them with the idea, why don't they divide the company? We'll buy all the non-consumer products business. Their multiple will go up and the combination will be a much higher value for their stockholders. And they said, boy, we like the value, but we have all these asbestos liabilities and it would be considered fraudulent transfer if we broke the company up because the lawyers want the full asset base to pay off these liabilities. So we took a deep breath and we said, okay, you like the value, why don't we just buy the whole thing at this value? And they said, okay. So we bought the whole thing and it was a huge deal for us, but it's been great. Our stuff works. And by the way, the way we look at acquisitions is we want several benefits. We want to believe that our management philosophy will substantially improve their business. We want them to have capabilities that we don't have so we can create new platforms for growth. So we want it to be win-win, one hand wash the other. It isn't just we take it over and tell them how to do. Right. No, we merge the two sets of capabilities to create more value.
Charles, half a century of growth, where did all the capital come from? You are still a privately held company. You did not buckle under at any point and go to the public markets.
Yeah, I don't think we would have been able to do. I mean, first of all, who's this kid that has all these crazy theories and is going to use our company as a laboratory? I mean, I'd have been fired long ago because we had lots of missed starts and
you had one failures. Choice, own it or lose your job.
That was it. And so staying private. So the way we did it, unfortunately, we had a small number of shareholders, so we could reinvest 90% of our profits in the business. And so that gave us the capital to continue to do that and still pay out enough so our stockholders had all the money they needed. And they had enough confidence in it that we could get a higher return on their capital than if we paid it out in dividends that they could get. Well,
last question about this 50 years of growth. You're a private company, not a public company, but you surely are aware of this concept of a conglomerate discount, where the market values conglomerates, public conglomerates, at less than the sum of their parts. And the thinking, very common thinking, is that a big diversified company, such as Coke, for example, just can't manage as effectively as a company that focuses on one tight industry, one tight grouping of products. Jeff Immelt at GE just got rid of, Jack Welch and Jeff Immelt, you get a narrowing of GE's products, the markets they're in, and so forth. So how do you've got these nine industry groups, you're a stonemason, and that stone, that beautiful stone edifice that you've built is a conglomerate. You've got an enormous different number of products and industries that you're in. How do you beat that tendency for a diffusion of management energy, for a lack of focus? How do you beat the conglomerate discount, so to speak?
Well, see, we don't look at it. Every business we've gone into was based on our having the capability to improve it and their having capabilities to open new opportunities for it. So one hand washes the other here. And all of these businesses are interrelated and work with each other. And we have, we try not to have big central bureaucracy, but what we have is a few specialist in each field. For example, in innovation, we put on twice a year innovation seminars. So all the people involved in product or process innovation get together and share ideas on innovation and driving radical innovation, driving creative destruction. And we bring in speakers and they share knowledge and then they build a community. This is the Republic of Science. So then when they have a question on this or that, they know who to call. And we do the same thing on operations excellence. So like most of our businesses are chemical process industries, so they have similar problems. So they share knowledge from that, so each one isn't reinventing the wheel.
So your core competency, you do have a core competency, you do have a focus, and it's the Republic of Coke. It's the intellect, it's the set of ideas, it's this these management techniques and the values.
Values come first, and then particular technologies and techniques come later. But the techniques and the procedures aren't valuable unless people understand the underlying principles. For example, incentives. They say, how do you do incentives? Well, we try to evaluate each year how much each employee has contributed to increasing the long-term value of Coke Industries, not just this year's earnings. Have you helped improve the culture? Have you built additional capabilities that haven't paid off this year but are promising for the future? We look at that whole thing. So our incentives aren't based on a formula. They're based on some objective measures, but largely they're subjective. And we spend tremendous amount of time on this, and we're not perfect. We measure with a micrometer and then cut with an axe because you can't really know. But we do it well enough that our people know that we're using our best efforts to reward them for the value they're creating. And not just for their business, but for the overall. For example, if you had an idea, you're working in Flint Hills, our refining and chemical. If you had an idea that helped Georgia Pacific or helped Invista, that's going to be in the evaluation. And even if it didn't help them that year, what we believe it'll help them for the future.
All right. From the Republic of Coke to the American Republic, you and your brother David have been active in supporting free market, libertarian think tanks, candidates, political causes. This has been going on for years. You helped found the Cato Institute in 1977 when Cato was founded. And in recent years, you've devoted large sums of money to political causes. Now, you get beat up in the press for this all the time. Right. Senator Bernie Sanders, campaigning for president, crisscrosses the country, naming you and your brother by name as bad guys.
Right.
Charles, let me clue you in on something here. Here's the way it's done. You retain a good lobbying firm in Washington quietly. You run the money through the corporation, not from your personal accounts. You get what you need done to get the legislation and the regulation that you need to increase your profits, and you keep your name out of the press. Now, why can't you see that?
I see that perfectly, and that's called corporate welfare, and that's one of the things that's destroying our country. We don't look at it that way, and I'm quite idiosyncratic in my approach to things, and that's true on politics. We don't look at policies on whether it's going to make us more money or not. We look at, will this help people improve their lives, or will it make their lives worse? And I see the biggest problem in the country, and I've complimented Bernie Sanders on this.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to get to that in a moment. Yep.
Is that we're in and increasingly becoming a two-tiered society that's destroying opportunities for the disadvantaged and creating welfare for the wealthy. So the primary issues we're working on, one is criminal justice reform. Another is improving the education system, particularly, well, all through K through 12 and universities, not only in policies, but in supplementing it. And we have a number of organizations that do that. Then in creating more of an open economy, so people who have nothing have the opportunity to get jobs, get started, and create well-being and meaning in their lives. And then that's on the one side. And then on the other side, to oppose all corporate welfare, all benefits. And the analysis we've seen is that this corporate welfare is costing the economy probably at least $5 trillion a year out of a $15 trillion economy. For example, the tax code alone has $1.5 trillion of special benefits and exemptions in it. And so we oppose all of that. And we say, no, as you know, this country was in theory founded on the idea of every human being has rights, unalienable rights, and there should be equal rights. And because this country applied it a little bit, it became the most prosperous country with the greatest well-being of any in the history of the world. But this was unique. All other countries were founded on the divine right of kings, or the emperor's a god, or the rulers have all the rights and the people have none. Now, the tragedy in this country, which is haunting us today, is that wasn't fully applied. Like, it was not applied at all for blacks and Native Americans. They weren't even considered fully human. They had no rights. So this has created a huge disaster in this country. Then women only had partial rights, and certain immigrants, such as the Chinese and the Irish and others, only had partial rights. And then this idea of corporate welfare, we had this in the beginning. Those who had an inside track got special deals. So just think, if this country had been founded in a way that was true to the Declaration of Independence, what we could be. And that's my ideal for the future. I think if we can move in that back to where we should have started from, we could create the greatest society, a better society than anyone ever dreamed of.
Charles, look.
So that's my dream.
So here's the argument. I just have to put it to you. This is from here's the argument. I said you get beat up in the press all the time. Here's a recent article in the New York Times. Quote, the Koch brothers and a small number of allied plutocrats, you can tell he's not on your side if you're talking about your friends as plutocrats, have essentially hijacked American democracy, using their money not just to compete with their political adversaries, but to drown them out, close quote. This notion that somehow you're too wealthy, that because you're as wealthy as you are, you have too many resources. It's unfair for you to weigh in politics because you just have more than others. How do you handle that?
Well, I mean, look at the money that we raise that goes into politics, which, we have a budget this year of, let's say, $500 million for all our activities. The great majority of that goes for education, for this new organization we're building called Stand Together, which works with these group who try to improve the lives of disadvantaged people, particularly minorities. And that's so exciting that if we can really help these people expand their capabilities. And then in think tanks, getting the ideas out, pushing for better policies, and just a fraction goes into electoral politics. As a matter of fact, I have said, okay, we're going to raise, let's say we over the two-year period, we raised $750 million total. I've been saying that probably $250 in that will go in politics, but because of our disappointment in the primaries, that I think it'll be significantly less than that. Our total will be about the same because there's more interest in these new things from our donors.
Okay, let's just take a moment to explain that. So when you say you're raising money, you and your brother put in substantial resources yourselves, but at this stage, you've put together a network of something like 300 or so like-minded individuals.
Four to 500.
People, you have your conference each year. There's a discussion about what the priorities are.
Two a year.
Okay. I just wanted to make clear that when you say you raise money, you are raising money as well as putting in your own resources.
Oh, yeah. The great majority of what we invest or help invest is coming from others.
Okay. So I want to come to the current, your disappointment in the primaries and so forth in a moment. But to look at that quotation I gave you the other way around, the New York Times piece that I quoted says, oh, it's, in some way it's illegitimate for wealthy people to get in. There's another way that that might be looked at, and it's just the other way around. And the way it might run is something like this, that people who have benefited from the free market system have some responsibility to defend what they have experience of it. They can see its shortcomings. Corporate welfare would be one in your case. But people in your position have something of a responsibility. And the surprise is not that Charles and David Koch have put together several hundred friends and like-minded people. The surprise is that there aren't more people. You can think Charles Koch, David Koch, Rupert Murdoch, Clifford Asness, Sean Field. You don't have to go very much beyond the fingers of two hands to think of prominent business leaders who take seriously American politics and are willing to speak under their own name. Why is that?
Well, I think first of all, I feel a moral, just as you say, I feel a moral obligation to do this. And I feel I have a, talk about a calling. I have a calling to do this. Unfortunately, the other parts have been effective. Like when I started in this, I started in education because I wanted, as I said, these ideas were transforming my life, and I wanted to give as many other people the idea that the opportunity to transform their lives. And then I could see that many of the policies were holding people back from fully applying these ideas to make their lives better. So we started working on trying to move America towards policies that will enable everybody to practice these, as opposed to where I saw us going, to a system of control, dependency, cronyism, and poverty that isn't creating this system of mutual benefit and general well-being, but a system that's pitting individuals and groups against each other. And then we got into electoral politics because I was very disappointed in what the Bush 43 administration was doing. They grew the government much more than Clinton. And even on the regulatory, they're supposedly deregulated. The regulations that they added were more than double what it was under Clinton. And so we got started in the political side in that administration to oppose what they were doing. It was a little hard because most business people are Republicans and they didn't want to oppose a Republican.
Let it be noted that the people who got you so ticked off you entered became politically active were Republicans,
yeah.
Not Democrats.
Well, I still feel that way, and the whole American population evidently feels that way. That's why they're going against the Republican politicians.
So, which brings us to the current primary season. Here's another question I have to ask. We've talked about business leaders who are willing to do something, and there's one, and his name is Donald Trump. What do you make of him?
Well, I don't like to comment about individuals because we're not into ad hominem attacks, but I can say this, I disagree with a lot of his policies, as you can tell from how I've been articulating what we stand for. And I've said this public before, I don't believe in protectionism. I don't believe in corporate welfare. I don't believe that, I believe in free speech. I don't believe in personally attacking people who disagree with you. And you see, I don't do that. I praise Bernie Sanders. He's attacking us. I praised him publicly and we made a video praise him. And it was interesting then, he and Hillary got into, in one of their debates, into a big conflict over our supposedly supporting Bernie Sanders, which was wonderful. But
to be clear, you agree with his diagnosis of what's wrong with the country.
Yeah.
You think he's completely wrong about expanding government to solve
the
problem.
Yeah, they'll just make more go down this path further, which is destroying people's lives and making the country worse.
A few final questions. The future of Koch Industries. One about the future of Koch Industries and one about the future of the country. Just two last questions. One final time, let me quote this book, Good Profit.
Thank you.
Going forward, Koch's vision is to double profits on average every 6 years. Double profits on average every 6 years. That implies a growth rate of about 12%?
12%, yeah.
And see, I told you I have an MBA.
Yeah, that's good. You could have gone to MIT.
12%. That's more than six times the rate at which the American economy has grown, pretty much year in and year out since 2008. You put that in here as a purely aspirational matter, or do you really believe this company, which is already worth $100 billion and employs 100,000 people, can continue to grow its profits at 12% a year?
Well, we can only do that at certain times, and that's not like I'm assuming and pushing our people to have an even slope up. Where we've grown, we've been flat for a while, and then we get a new opportunity, we jump up, and then we're flat for a while. So that doesn't mean every 6 years, but that's why I say on average.
I see.
Over 50 years. And
but there's still room for growth in your mind.
Oh, yeah. But we've got to find new platforms for growth, and that's why we bought Molex, and we have a lot of other investments in information technology. And our goal is to turn all our products and processes into smart products and processes. For example, we operate a lot of plants that are dangerous, either because that some of the raw materials or the intermediates are toxic, or because they're explosive. So you have what's the technology today? Somebody with a sniffer, a detector, walks around to see if there are any of these. We're working on a process that will have monitors everywhere and will automatically not only detect it, but shut the unit down. I mean, that's a smart product and processes. Then we, Georgia Pacific's working on the bathroom, the public bathroom of the future, which will be cleaner, use lower energy, not run out of anything, and so on. So we're working on that everywhere, and so, and then we're broadening Molex's product lines to enable us to better do this, so it'll benefit them and our other companies. Once again, it's win-win. It's how the different pieces fit together. And then we're doing the same thing in biotechnology.
I said I had one more question, but I actually have, this just occurred to me. It's been a long time, Charles, since you had anything to prove to anybody. And you've just turned 80. It's been half a century of building this company. And yet everybody I talked to in your organization said, oh no, Mr. Koch is still putting in 9-hour days.
Well, it's much more than that. That's just at the office. Come on. No, I go home and work out and have dinner, and then I work some more.
Well, what are you doing? Look, there's a golf course right outside your window here.
Yeah, and I might play one day a week or one day every other week.
But truly, what keeps you at it?
It's I take what Shakespeare said, that that's what's won is done. Joy's soul is in the doing. So, I mean, it goes with Maslow and the psychologists, what they've found. What gives you fulfillment and long-term happiness is accomplishing something. And they find that if you accomplish something and then that's it, what are you just gonna brag about you did that? It's like somebody got a PhD and that's their high point in their life. They're just gonna sit at rest on their laurels. No, you become very unhappy, become bored. What you gotta do is keep growing and learning and finding new ways to contribute. That's the way you feel good about yourself.
All right. Now my final question, the future of the country. I'm quoting now from a column, your column in the Chicago Tribune, in which you said, I agree with Bernie Sanders. You agree with his diagnosis of
that was in the Washington Post.
I'm sorry, the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Quote, so I'm quoting that column. It is results, not intentions, that matter. History has proven that a bigger, more controlling, more complex, and costlier federal government leaves the disadvantaged less likely to improve their lives, close quote. History of the Soviet Union proves that. It was a failure.
Right.
History of many of our own social programs. You yourself noted in that column that since President Johnson declared war on poverty in 1964, we spent $22 trillion on poverty, and the poverty rate hasn't budged barely a percentage point. So here is the question. All of that evidence that big government is a problem, particularly for the poor, and yet in a recent poll, this is in Iowa, during the leading up to the Iowa caucuses, 43% of Democratic Iowa caucus goers, and the largest percentage among young people, called themselves socialists. Called themselves socialists, despite it all. Are you optimistic about the future of this country?
Well, we've got to change the narrative, and we've got to learn to do a better job of communicating what makes people's lives better, what will give them happy, fulfilling lives. And it's, as you pointed out, it's not socialism. And now this is what they're getting from almost all the media at almost all universities and schools, that this socialism is good. So, but fortunately, there's technology there. There's alternative media, and there are more and more groups that are realizing that this is a dead end. And so what we're trying to do in our network is reach out and innovate, drive creative destruction in this area, find new and better ways to show people this is a dead end for you. The way to live a better life and have a more moral society is to go away from this system of control and dependency and perpetual property.
Charles Koch, author of Good Profit, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.